3, 2, 1.
Boom! And we are on. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another exciting episode of The Renegade Show. And today we have, in my opinion, a real renegade. He's a man who's been at the forefront of energy, waste, and green revolution for a long time. And I'm excited to have him here on our podcast. Welcome to the pod, Grant.
Thank you, Kelvin.
Great. So Grant, tell the listeners about yourself and how did you stumble on energy and eco's green and waste management? How did you get into that? And the time you went in wasn't very popular.
Yeah. So I've had kind of a long career. I don't want to say how old I am, but I've got enough gray hair that you probably can tell. But I've done work overseas. And so I've seen things in Southeast Asia. I've seen things in Africa. I've seen things throughout Europe. I lived 13 years in Japan. Just as a side note, I speak Japanese as well, even though I would never look like I speak Japanese. But because I've seen things, I have seen the waste and stuff that goes through there. So I've always had kind of a side with the environmental. I'm one, if the garbage blows into my yard, I'm one of the first ones to pick it up. Maybe my neighbors don't do it, but I'm always out there picking up garbage. So I've had a big concern over the environment for years and years. So we've always thought there's a better way to do it. Unfortunately, as a Canadian and living in Ontario in the Toronto area, we see everyone's idea of waste is you put your garbage out on the curb, someone comes by and picks it up and it disappears. And we never really think about what happens with that garbage and where it goes. So most of it being in Ontario anyway, most of it is going to landfill. It used to go into the US, go into Michigan. Now I think only industrial and commercial waste goes there. But it's really kind of sad to see how much of our stuff actually goes there instead of actually following along the ideas of reduce, reuse, and recycle. Mm-hmm. And so we've always tried to do things a little bit better. If I tell you what we're doing a little bit now, we've taken a look at the problem and it kind of came evidence when everyone's looking at reducing the amount of single-use plastic because people have not had a solution for that. And so everything that we put into the blue box for the recycling, of the plastic that goes in there, only 8% of the plastic is actually recycled. The rest of it is anything that has food stuck to it, that has paper stuck to it, maybe a sticker or two, will typically go and it goes back to landfill. So if you visited a landfill here in Ontario, you'd be really surprised at how much plastic is just blowing around as a waste.
It's interesting that you talked about the garbage gets shipped out. And when we were talking before the show, I was telling you that the Canadian rubbish ends up in my home country of Malaysia and in the island, the beautiful island of Penang. And there's this idea of not in my backyard, the NIMBY movement. And so I wanted to get your point of view in terms of why is this NIMBY movement there, at least in the developed country versus the developing countries, they're not taking a stance on it? So talk to us about that, what you're seeing in the ecosystem.
Well, unfortunately, people are very selfish. That's my opinion. And they don't look at the greater good. They look at about what only affects them. Mm-hmm. So the people who are putting in solar, the same thing. So they're going to put a solar plant maybe down the road and someone doesn't want it to go there because they don't want to look at it. People that put up the wind turbines as well, they don't want to see the wind turbines. And then you get people who join them and they come up with different ideas as to why it's unhealthy or any of these things, which I'm sorry to say is there's no science with it that actually says that it's unhealthy. No one's been able to prove this. David Suzuki's come up and he's spoken against it, really saying that he'd be happy to see renewable energy and stuff come in. But I think it's just people have this not in my backyard, this NIMBYism, where they think that if it's not there, they don't have to think about it. Mm-hmm. And it goes back with the garbage. If the garbage is going to Malaysia or the garbage is going to a landfill, so long as they don't have to see it, they don't have to smell it, they're okay with that. And this is, I think, is the inherent trait that we have really here in the first world countries. When you go overseas, maybe it's a little bit different because they don't have the means to escape it and such.
And so what was it in your upbringing and in your family and your values that drove you to have this idea of protecting Mother Earth? Because like you say, it's not something that everyone potentially may come and do it, but you chose to not only embrace it, you made it your profession when in a time when people were doing other things. What was it in your upbringing or values that made you like this?
Well, my first education was in the military. So in the military, everyone has very strict rules that you follow. And so this is going back, what's this now, over 30 years now, when I was in the military. And at that time, we had to separate garbage and do things in there. So the military first had an idea of the ecology and doing separation and stuff, at least being able to take the glass and taking the aluminum and stuff out of the system. And more recently, I guess in the last 20 years, has been mainly because I've got children. Mm-hmm. And so a big focus with me as being a parent, I'm not a new parent, but at the same time, being a parent, I really want things to be better for my children than mm-hmm. I've had. And as we see now, everything from pollution, cancer is taking off. And some of it is because of chemical waste and people are saying like plastic in the water, the plastic is getting into our system. And when they're doing studies on people, they can find it into our bodies. So I'd really like to see the world become better mm-hmm. so that we don't have to make not just the earth sick, but make ourselves sick.
So as a parent, how did you cultivate this idea of being green and caring about Mother Earth beyond just the recycling? What did you instill in your children? Because we have parents listening, obviously, to this podcast. How did you manage to cultivate that care in your kids?
Okay. With my kids, anyway, they follow what I do. So it's very good. And my daughter, who is 19, she likes to argue. So I think she takes a little bit of her father's influence on that. So we debate things a lot, and mm-hmm. I'm very interested in what people of her generation think as well. Mm-hmm. And so we can see because of Greta Thunberg and all these different things with the children, mm-hmm. they really are thinking of the environment. So if I were in my house, which I don't do, but if I took a plastic water bottle and threw it into the regular garbage, mm-hmm. I would get scolded by my kids. And that's not even from my influence. That's just from their own peers and what they're taught in school. So mm-hmm. I'm happy that the children of today are actually looking at the environment for tomorrow.
So are you hopeful, like, because of this new generation of children who are more socially conscious, also mission-driven, I think they're also supporting companies that actually not only just say on ads that they support the ecosystem or the environment, but they actually do it. Do you feel a shift now in the generational shift in the young?
I see that, but I also see that they all have an idea that they want to mm-hmm. follow or an ideology of it. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's kind of led astray because they don't have the ideas to actually how to implement it. Mm-hmm. If I give you an example, fossil fuels are bad. This is what they're saying. We got to stop using oil. We got to go back into, everyone should be using electric cars. We should be doing this. I'm not too sure about you, but I can't snap my fingers and suddenly say, okay, we're suddenly going to get rid of gasoline. We're going to suddenly get rid of oils. We're suddenly going to stop using plastics. That's just really not a practical matter at the time being. In the future, maybe. So that should be a long-term goal. But mm-hmm. we always have short-term goals that we have to be able to bring into place. And this is where I think there's a little disconnect with the youngsters of today because they don't know how to meet the short-term goals. They all have this idea that they want to do for long-term goals.
Interesting. And as we were talking, you mentioned that you've been across the world in many countries and your job took you to the most interesting places. And you also said that you had to get your hands dirty in those places. Talk to us about the dirty side of the business. What did you experience firsthand?
Well, I can give you a good example. So there is a garbage dump. I don't want to say a landfill. It's not really a proper landfill. That's in Mumbai in India. And it is it's quite amazing because you can actually see the garbage dump from space. It's that big. And so I think they said it's close to 30,000 tons per day of waste is dumped into that site. And it's because it's not really, I wouldn't say managed properly or not really a proper landfill, it catches fire. And they have fires that break out every year because the methane gets trapped and it's basically an explosion. And it'll burn, and there's so much plastic in there that it's toxic. And so they've had to close schools, but you've also got families that live on the same dump site. So it's kind of scary. So I remember going to a meeting with the Mumbai Municipal Corporation, they call it, which is the city corporation. And suddenly they said, well, let's go take a look at the site. And I thought, okay, we're going to go in a 4x4 and go through the site. I had to climb into the back of a garbage truck wearing my suit and had to stomp through the garbage, taking a look around there. No mask, no gloves, no sort of personal protective equipment and going through there. And I ended up breathing in some very bad fumes, and I was sick for about 2 weeks. I actually thought I was going to die. I was shaking and shivering and had to cancel flights. And basically my hotel room was my friend for the last little while. So.
And even after that experience, you decided to make a career in waste management after you've gone through energy drilling. And so talk to us about that transition to waste management and then the technologies you're now developing to kind of use waste management in a different way.
Well, someone once told me the way to make money is to do something that no one else wants to do. And so that sort of hit home. So we started looking at different ways where we could do it. But as we had probably last year, it was really everyone's talking about plastic, plastic. We got to stop getting rid of, stop using paper coffee cups because it can't be recycled. We've got to stop using drinking straws, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we said, okay, well, you do have, currently we have these things that are in the system. And like I said, they don't get recycled. They go to, they basically go to landfill. And then the recent part with the pandemic, all the hospital waste and stuff like this, there is not a decrease in the amount of plastic. Currently, right now, the use of plastic has gone up. You look at the supermarkets, you can't bring your own bags in there anymore. In most of the supermarkets, they've gone back to giving you plastic bags, which it's a step backwards. So we took a look at how can we deal with the waste in a way that's going to help the environment, but also, I guess, do good, and we can make money by doing good. So we brought in a technology where we can take this waste plastic, all the stuff that can't be recycled, and we can turn that and convert it actually into a renewable fuel. And by using a renewable fuel, we can then bring down the carbon emissions, and as well as having it as a clean carbon, carbon-free fuel in order to mix it, blend it, and help the environment. So we kind of do two things. We deviate the plastic that will go to landfill, and we create renewable fuels that can be mixed in and help bring down the emissions and the carbon.
Right. And so here's an example of a technology being used to do good. But if you look at even emerging countries or even matured economies, there is a segment of the population that are what we call climate deniers, or folks that believe that, you know, technology should be used for other things than environment. Why is there this divide? Wouldn't humanity agree that this is probably a better way of actually using technology to solve our environmental challenge? Why do we have a divide here?
Again, I keep bringing up this word that we have, which is laziness a little bit. People don't want to actually know. They kind of bury their heads in the sand and they say, okay, well, why do we need to change? And this could be from anyone who's maybe in the industry that is benefiting from it, no change. An example of this might be coal companies and coal mines and such there. So they, because their income comes from coal, their big focus is, okay, let's sell coal, let's do things. Here we have in Canada, I know you've got subscribers that are from all over the world that are maybe listening to this. So you've got different aspects with it, and people are inherently selfish. It's what benefits them is what they think at. So for me, I would be very happy when it's time for me to finally pass on, when I actually saw people that are looking at the greater good instead of just looking centered in what's good for them.
And we've got the Paris Climate Accord, but we have all these accords, but I think the enforcement, the monitoring, the behaviors need to follow those protocols. But I think economies are really very local. And if you look at in today's world, everyone is worried about lives and livelihoods. So no one's, like as you mentioned, right? No one's looking at the environment. Plastics have gone up. So there is almost like a tug of war between the planet we are living in versus the reality we have to face. And so from your perspective as a technologist, as a person who's seeing this front end, what could each and every one of us do in our own way to be able to help with this? Is it pick at the lobby, the government? Like, what can we do for ourselves, the small concrete things that we can do?
Well, I think we're lucky in this stage in Canada anyway, yeah, and there are people who would disagree with me, that we do have a government. And like I said, I don't agree with everything government does, mm-hmm. but at the same time, we do have a government here, both from a provincial level or whatever, who at least have an awareness. Mm-hmm. And that's the first thing there is. If you're not aware of it, you just put your head in the sand and you're not even looking at anything, how can you look at improvements? So, you know, I think we should always focus on the awareness, mm-hmm. and then also coming up with solutions that are not painful to react. So, for example, what we're doing, or what we want to do, and again, I'm not trying to give a plug for what we're doing or the technology, mm-hmm. but by helping out things currently that are going on, it doesn't really change your lifestyle. You'd still, when you fill up your car and you go and put fuel in your car or put diesel into a truck or whatever like this, mm-hmm. if it's mandated to blend in order to help reduce the carbon, then you're still selling oil. Mm. Okay? We're not weaning ourselves off oil completely, mm-hmm. but you are reducing the amount of oil. So it's sort of a win-win. It keeps the oil still flowing and still being in there, but at the same time, you're helping the environment by being able to cut down the carbon emissions that are in there. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Have we reached, at least in your perspective, a level of technology where renewables can actually sustain the Earth's energy needs? Because the argument against, you know, weaning ourselves from traditional energy sources, whether you call it old coal or new coal or clean coal or drilling or fracking, is that renewables will not be able to have a technology pace that can support life. What's your perspective if someone's trying to break this barrier?
Well, I see there's advances. So if I went 20 years ago and someone said, you're going to see all these electric cars driving on the road, I would say, you're crazy. Mm-hmm. Because we didn't have the technology at that time to be able to put in good batteries and get a distance from there. And to me, we're seeing like Tesla has just done a fantastic job. Mm-hmm. They went around and created a luxury brand, which mm-hmm. is in there, which has actually got now a distance. The batteries you can jump in your car and you can drive as much as you want that day before you depleted the battery. At least in the summer when it's a little warmer, you're not depleting the battery, you can go. So every day we've got technology which is going out there. New one that's been talking is hydrogen. Okay. Mm-hmm. And to me, hydrogen is very nice, provided you can come from a fairly clean source. And again, there's no emissions. When you're using hydrogen in these systems, you're getting water vapor, which is going off, or you're getting a little bit of oxygen off it, but you're not really harming, you're not putting carbon into the atmosphere. So it's great. The problem we have right now with hydrogen is it's not energy dense. Batteries themselves are not energy dense. So it's very hard to compare apples to apples because mm-hmm. we haven't got a technology yet that has been able to fully replace what we've been doing with fossils. It's not there. So we have transition technologies which can kind of come in there, which help everything, but we're not fully at a place to replace things yet.
And when you look at the in order for technology to advance and for innovations to come, one of the key ingredients is talent. But we're starting to see, when I was doing some research, that the enrollment for environmental sciences or energy sciences or anything that is going to advance environment or energy is actually dwindling. Like the enrollments are down, and the younger workforce or the folks going to universities are not enrolling in this thing. And it's very different from in your time, where people actually wanted to enroll in this. Is it we are doing not enough a good job to promote these sciences or qualifications, or is there just a gap in terms of people's ability to go in?
Well, I see it two ways. So every time we come into, so look at the IT factor a number of years ago. Mm-hmm. So someone who wanted to go into the IT field, maybe let's go back about 15 years ago, mm-hmm. guys were coming out of university with an IT degree and walking into these $100,000 jobs.
Yes.
Right. And then so suddenly everyone says, this is great. I can make money by getting into the IT field. Mm-hmm. So everyone rushed in.
Right.
And not just in North America, people around the world rush into it, like in India and emerging nations and stuff rushed into it. So right now, if I want IT work to be done, why would anyone work in the IT field here? Well, they can find jobs in there, but those $100,000 jobs fresh out of university are no longer there, because we can now subcontract it to someone in India who can do it for a fraction of the cost. Mm-hmm. So years ago, when people were getting into more of a thing looking at the environmental field, mm-hmm. again, you had people who rushed into it, again, for the right reasons, mm-hmm. but where they could get good jobs and things. But I think nowadays, people are not making the same money that they could have a number of years ago, because too many people went into the sector. Mm-hmm. And so people are now getting into, I say, the sexier jobs, which is more technology driven. Mm-hmm. From talking with my daughter, this is where the kids want to go now. They mm-hmm. want to go into something that is shiny. It's got all the bells and whistles with it. And plus they can make good money. That's mm-hmm. that's more what they're looking at.
Yeah. And so if we were to look at what could be done, is it a function of private and public, partnerships to drive the need for research, the need for skills to innovate in this area? Or is it just a matter of academia trying to make this a priority for them? Or what do you think, in your perspective, needs to be done to kind of correct this course?
Well, I think you've got the right target there. It is a blend between private sector and also the public sector. So universities themselves don't have money. Okay. Mm. So anytime you talk to a research department in the universities, they're hungry for funding. They're hungry for all these things. I can give an example with University of Waterloo, which has got probably the best co-op program in the world, as far as I've seen, but they're driven by the private sector that's coming in and offering these positions. They're driven by the research funds that can be given to the universities. This is really what keeps the universities going. And in Canada, we're lucky that tuition costs, even though it's expensive, is much more reasonable than some other places, which I can say, like south of our border, which it's really, really expensive to go to university. It's not driven so much by the research and development that you get into the university programs as what we've got here or in other places. And so I think between government offering some incentives for the research, plus the universities having a good focus on it, and actually identifying the private sector that they want to work with, I think it's a combination of all these factors coming in together, which is going to drive a solution-based business that we have, not just for the environment, but for everything else in the world.
Do you also think that there's also what I would call a bubble and a boom and a bust within the renewable side? And what I was really mentioning is, you take a look at the example of Solyndra, right? Solyndra, a silicon company, pioneering solar panels. And at that point, when I think it was during the Obama administration, money was being thrown into renewables and solar and all the systems that were going to support it. And then this shakeup with Solyndra happened, but the entire ecosystem kind of also suffered, pushed down the prices. People got disenfranchised. So we see bubbles happening in renewable tech. So are you seeing an emergence of certain bubbles in certain areas, or where are we in the state of renewable tech?
Well, we are getting into a little bit of saturation, I think, with, I don't want to speak for everyone, but in the solar market, we are reaching a point of saturation where you had a few players that were in there originally going into it. Mm-hmm. And again, it's like the IT field. When you get too many players that go in there, you drive down the costs. I mean, you drive down the cost to the consumer, but at the same time, you drive down the players in there. So you don't want to have people don't want to go into that now, because instead of having three competitors, now you have 3,000 competitors. So if someone wanting to put a small solar farm in, or they want to put something on top of buildings, you've got now lots of choices, and you can look around with it till you can get the lowest price. So again, I keep bringing up the idea that people are a little bit selfish. That's good for the consumer, because by having a lot of people that are looking at it, but at the same time, if we don't keep the costs up, you're not going to be driving innovation.
As we end the session, what's your hope for all the renegades out there looking to get into the world of energy waste management and renewables? What's your hope that they can actually take from where you see the industry going, and also the good that you can do?
I think the first thing is look in their own backyards. That's the biggest thing. So if you can't see it, like I said about the NIMBYism, it's not prevalent to you. And it's, I think, for the young people, if the young people can identify this and bring it to light, then more people are going to be aware of what happens. There was a YouTube video that was out there that had a bear with a big plastic bucket stuck on its head. That had, I think it had 3 million views in it, just in a very, very short time. So people said, here tonight, you have a plastic problem because you got bears stuck with buckets on their head. So that gives, again, an idea that people shouldn't be throwing plastics out to the wild like that. So again, awareness and solutions. Those are the biggest thing that I would like to have people more focused on.
And with that, thank you, Grant, for coming on the pod. It's been a fascinating conversation. And for me, our children inherit that, but I'm also optimistic that our future generations that's coming now, have some sort of a responsibility and actually a push towards taking care of Mother Earth. So I'm really encouraged by that. So thank you, Grant, for sharing your experience, your wisdom.
Okay, well, thank you for having me, Kelvin. And I guess hopefully we can meet again.